Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie, and I'm delighted to be interviewing Faye Mashler, the great restaurant critic, who began as Evening Standard restaurant critic in 1972 and is now Tatler restaurant critic. And I believe you began having won a competition, is that right?
That's right, yes. They ran a competition. Quentin Crewe was then restaurant critic and left for reasons that have never been disclosed or was fired, I don't know. Anyway, they were competition mad in those days at the Evening Standard. So this competition was launched and the prize was to be restaurant critic for 3 months. And a friend of mine, I'd had two children by this point and was champing at the bit about being at home with small children. So this friend of mine showed me the competition in the paper and I entered on the last day. And I made a short list of three, and then we all had to do it again, which involved reviewing three restaurants with a theme, because that was Quentin's style. And anyway, apparently, I heard later from Simon Jenkins, who was features editor, that there was a great deal of argy-bargy about who should win, and Charles Winter, who was then editor, got bored with it and said, oh, fuck it, give it to the girl. I was the only female in the trio. So I did it for 48 years, which was partly because it suited my life very well. I enjoyed it, and it meant I could work from home and be with my children, but also it was a nice social life. And restaurants over that period, between 72 and whenever it was I left in 20-something, developed so much and so brilliantly, really.
And paint me a picture of what the restaurant scene was like in London in 1972.
Well, it was pretty rudimentary and it was pretty class conscious, class divided. I mean, there were, you know, some people who would eat in their club or at a hotel or at one of those sort of grand places like Les Coups de France or the Mirabel. And then there were Bangladeshi restaurants that people thought were Indian, and then there were sort of rather bogus bistros with names like Grumbles and Tethers. And there wasn't sort of, and there were Italian restaurants, but of a very inauthentic kind. But people loved them for the reasons people still love Italian restaurants. So there wasn't much, you know. It was too divisive, too separate in terms of the people it appealed to. And I don't think anyone knew the name of a chef. I mean, you might know the name of a manager, maitre d', but until the Roux brothers came along in 67, and their names became bandied about a bit, Albert and Michel Roux, you know, the chefs didn't figure, but then they began to.
And if you think London was limited, I mean, growing up in a child in the 70s, outside London, incredibly limited,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes. I mean, luckily, because the Evening Standard's a London paper, I didn't have to put that to the test too much. I always felt sorry for the National Restaurant Critics, who felt obliged to go to Newcastle. I didn't have to do that.
And so it's obviously changed beyond recognition now. If there was a turning point or a time it changed, when do you think it was?
Well, I've said, when I've been asked this question, 1987, which is when Marco Pierre White opened Harvey's, Rose Gray and Ruthie Rogers opened the River Cafe, Rolly Lee opened Kensington Place, and Simon Hopkinson went to Bibendum.
All in that year, how interesting.
Yeah, and it was interesting too because the chefs I'm mentioning, apart from Marco, they were sort of a different breed, you know. Rolly and Simon had been to, Simon went to choir school, Rolly had been to university. It was different. It wasn't that faceless person behind the green baize door, but they became, Alistair Little was another who I think changed the scene a lot.
And in terms of the writing, had you always longed to be a restaurant critic, or it was literally because that was what the competition was?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been a copywriter at J. Walter Thompson and another agency. Then I worked for the Radio Times. So I was a sort of writer. And I'd always liked food, and I'd always liked eating out. And my parents, my father anyway, had to entertain for his business, and they would often take me along. He was a civil engineer, and he was of that generation where you went to work for a company and then you stayed with that company for all of your life. So he worked for BICC, British something, calendars, cables, and he opened the New York office. So when I was 12, we moved to Greenwich, Connecticut. And I used to go out with them quite often, and it kind of piqued my interest in eating out. But also, I didn't know a soul in Old Greenwich for the first long, hot summer. And I started cooking just to do something, you know, to occupy myself. And I found I could follow recipes and make them work. And I found it kind of turned the tables a bit, because if you start making food for your parents, it alters the balance of power. And I could see the point of that, you know. And the point of it stayed with me all my life.
And journalism is a funny thing. I think if you can do it, it doesn't seem to me particularly difficult. But if you can't do it, you can never do it. And did you find you just had the knack?
I suppose I did have the knack. I mean, I enjoyed copywriting because you change your style to suit the thing you were promoting. But I think I just, yeah, I guess I had a knack of writing quite naturally. And, of course, you know, writing about a meal could be incredibly boring, and there's plenty of examples of that still. But if you turn it into a bit of a story, then it can be entertaining. And Quentin was a great mentor in that sense, not that I knew him then, but he really brought wit and he to the business. And he would review a restaurant as if he was reviewing a party or a play. You know, he'd mention the characters, the decor, the jokes, etc., etc. And that was a very big change from the way restaurant criticism had been, which was mostly underpinned by advertising and therefore
it had
unbelievable as well as boring.
We begin with the onion soup and we move on to the lamb chops before.
That sort of thing. And my companion had the pâté
right. And
washed it down with a very rewarding glass of house red.
Right.
It was
Yeah. Whereas actually you, I've just been reading a few of your brilliant Tatler columns. You brought in the idea of an ideal evening with inspired by Lou Reed's Perfect Day, saying, and then later a movie too, and then home, talking about seeing a film at the Curzon Bloomsbury, followed by a meal at Noble Rot Wine Bar and Restaurant in Landscundit Street. And so a meal is more than just the food on the plate. It can be a million different things. It can be a romantic meal. It can be with your parents.
Yeah.
Those combinations are almost endless, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's become so democratized now, which is great, you know, in all kinds of ways, not just about who goes, but what you pay and the hours. You know, the hours used to be rigid. I mean, you know, lunch would be 1 until 3 and dinner, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's revolutionized now. And people often say London is one of the great cities now for eating out.
Which I would agree with.
Yeah.
And also you recently reviewed Bacchanalia, which suggestions were that it costs £26 million for the fit-out and £68 million for the whole project. But actually, do you find those figures obscene or ludicrous, or what do you think?
They are slightly ludicrous. It's a Richard Caring restaurant, which makes it ludicrous anyway. But it is astonishing, the interior. It really is. And it seems to thrive. And I suppose it's a way, if you have tons of money, it's a way of using it.
And I was told by a restaurateur friend, I said, that's extraordinary, they'll never make it back. And he said, they'll make that back in 3 years, he said.
And have they?
I don't know.
No, I don't know.
But he said they're in the perfect Mayfair Triangle where people want to spend more for food.
And they want to be seen to be spending. And they're not that interested in how great the food is.
Yeah.
And it's got these wonderful statues, Damien Hirst's statues flying around. And, you know, I've never been back. I went once to review it.
And how was the food?
It was sort of adequate, very expensive wine list. I went with an Irish friend of mine, and he said, could he have his veal, not with polenta, but with potatoes? And this poor, hapless waiter dressed in costume, because they were dressed as kind of Roman slaves, with, you know, in a tunic and sandals with laces up his calf. And I think he was Eastern European of some kind. And he looked absolutely hunted. And I turned to him and I said, I'm sorry, my friend is Irish. And he said, is that an allergy? I said, absolutely. Anyway, so we had fun.
Yeah. And would you say, I must say, it still is quite difficult, particularly now, to find a good, not a spectacular meal in London relatively cheaply. Or you say you still can do that?
Yeah, it takes a bit more research, probably. But there's such choice now. And still people seem willing to pay absurd prices.
Where would you go? And they for let's say, a good dinner for 30 quid. Or lunch, or...
Yeah, well, that narrows the field a bit.
Yeah, maybe that's...
I mean, just recently, prices are... You know, it's very hard now, if you're in a fairly serious restaurant, to get out for less than £100 a head.
Yeah.
And I remember when bills reached £100 for two, and I was protesting, saying this is outrageous.
And that was only,
immoral,
what, 20 years ago?
And that was probably 20 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And to go back to your background, you were born in India.
Yeah.
Because that's where your father...
That's where my father
was
working for British Insulated Counters Cables was, yes.
And how long were you there for?
18 months. Oh. We left at partition in 1947.
So you couldn't really say it had much of an effect on you, or you never know?
Well, I like to think it did. I went back to India for the first time in my 30s, probably late 30s. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know this place. And I think when you're a baby, things get imprinted, like colours and language, the sound of language. And I just felt very at home, and I've been back a lot.
And also, you said you moved to Connecticut later on. That, I think, with children, has a big effect, being able to put up with great moves like that.
Yes. Of course, you don't think about it at the time, but it's true. And, you know, to move out, we went out. My dad went out first to open the office in New York. We left my sister back here in the UK to do her O-levels. So it was just my mum and me. And we went out on the Queen Mary. I remember that quite well. And, you know, I was really lonely. She was probably really lonely too. And she had got used to having naps in the afternoon in India. So she would nap in the afternoon there. And that was when I really had to sort of find my own entertainment. And luckily it was cooking, not anything else.
And your sister is Beth Coventry, who runs a wonderful Wells Tavern in Hampstead. Is that just coincidence you both ended up in food, for want of a better word?
It must be a bit more than coincidence, I think. Our mum was actually a really good cook. I mean, when she came back from India in 47, it was the coldest winter ever. And for reasons I've never fathomed, we were in Newcastle. And she got hold of a Mrs. Beaton book, and the recipe was for jugged hare, and it said, first catch your hare, which would be daunting even now. And nevertheless, she taught herself, and what I loved about her food was it really tasted of itself. So whether that was much of an influence, I don't know. Well, and then I started cooking. Then Beth loved Greece, and she went and worked as a sort of chalet girl in Greece, summer after summer, cooking there, self-taught. And then she opened Green's restaurant, Oyster Bar, in Duke Street, St. James, and managed somehow to run the kitchen. So I guess we were just sort of...
There must have been something there, yeah.
Yeah. But I used to help with dinner parties, and so, you know, food was quite germane to our existence.
And to go back to your early days at the Standard, Charles Winter was your editor, and everyone says a brilliant editor, is that right?
He was really brilliant. He was terrific, yeah.
And what makes for him a terrific editor and more generally a good editor?
Well, he took a real interest. He would always read the copy. If he liked it, he'd send me a postcard. And then, of course, one felt elated to get a praise like that. I remember after my first review, and it was of a Greek restaurant off Queensway, he went and tried it out to see if the review actually reflected how the restaurant was. And that's proper attention.
Yeah.
And some aren't. I think I worked my way through about 13 in my tenure there.
Yeah.
And, I was terrified of Charles, but everyone was terrified of Charles. And then, you know, there were a few others who I would single out as very good editors.
He was terrifying intentionally, do you think, or just because he was impatient at not getting that perfection?
Well, he was just very... I was, you know, quite young, so I was more easily terrified. But I think people respected him. He was very meticulous, strict, didn't suffer fools gladly. But it was a really nice paper to work for and remained that way. There was a very nice atmosphere there.
I worked there as a gossip columnist and loved it in about 2000. Had terrific
Who was the
writers.
Editor?
Max Hastings.
Well, he was good.
Yeah, he was terrific. Yeah. And also, you know, Brian Sewell was the art critic. I was on the gossip column on his diary, which had about half a dozen people working on it. And it is a terrible decline, isn't it, the Standard?
Yeah, it's very sad. It's really sad. In the old days, it was everybody read the Standard. Didn't matter if you read The Telegraph or The Guardian in the morning, you'd buy the Standard in the evening, and because there were so many editions, you could break stories. And, yeah, I mean, I remember hearing in a roundabout way that I reviewed a restaurant that was being... It was involved with David Linley, the Queen's...
Nephew.
Anyway, I heard in a roundabout way that the Queen had said to him, "Hey, darling, I saw that woman in the Standard not being terribly nice." I thought, great, it's great that she reads it. Everybody reads it.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And it's a good riposte, although it was a joke when Max Hastings went off to go and edit the Standard, having edited the Telegraph. Conrad Black, the then owner, said, "Sad to see you're off to edit a local paper." Mm. But it was a fantastic paper with international offices across the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and great people. And people, as you say, like Brian Sewell, Milton Shulman, you know, people who worked, and there was Sam White from Paris, yeah. People who worked for long periods. So then people can latch onto that, relate to it.
And even when I worked there, well, it was in 2000, there were three editions. You had the excitement of the first edition going, and then if you were a bleary-eyed gossip columnist, you'd go to the party and you'd catch the third edition. And it was all the thrill of the press. What do you think the turning point in its decline was?
I think I would say when it got sold to Lebedev.
Yeah, undeniably, yeah.
And that was, to some extent, thanks to Geordie Gregg, who for a while was the editor. And he tried to sack me, so I have a very dim view of Geordie Gregg.
It's a good expression. Try to sack. How did you go about doing that?
Well, every time a new editor had come along, including Paul Dacre, they would take me out for a meal. That was sort of, I don't know, considered polite, I suppose. And I remember Paul took me to the Connaught, which was certainly not his hunting ground, but he said, "I know you like this place." And Max took me to the Ritz. And, you know, I just thought, well, that's how you get to know the new editor. Anyway, I heard not a word from Geordie. So I said to somebody working there, "What should I do?" And she said, "Oh, well, just go in and meet him. He has a very open door policy. He's very easy to talk to." So I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I went in, because I will work from home. I never went into the office. And he went to his office and he said, among first things he said was, "I think we need a fresh face."
It's a brilliant, brilliant, ruthless euphemism, isn't it?
I said, "Yeah, well, maybe." Anyway, the fresh face turned out to be, what's he called? That writer, David, he became the literary editor.
Sexton.
David Sexton, hardly a fresh face in my view, but anyway. Then Geordie said, do you know that poem about a waiter? It's very short. And I said, no, tell me, what is it? And he said, it goes like this. I think it was Ogden Ash. It goes like this. By and by, God caught his eye. No, which is basically saying, fuck off and die. So I said, actually I did know that poem. Not poem, but a doggerel.
Yes.
Went home, burst into tears, threw myself into the arms of Reg, rang my lawyer, and I didn't leave. He should never have done any of that. You have to have human, resources. You can't just say to somebody who's been there a long time and quite successfully, I think we need a fresh face, and then produce David Sexton.
And then
I've nothing against David Sexton.
But it worked. He didn't then.
He wasn't able to. It would have cost him the earth to get rid of me on spurious grounds of age. You can't do that.
And then, crazily, just, I think, 2 years short of your 50th anniversary of working at the Standard, you did go. What were the circumstances there?
I did have a feeling, enough was enough in a way. But actually what got me leaving was Emily Sheffield becoming the editor.
Yeah.
I mean, she was ill-equipped to do it.
Extremely good way of putting it, yes. Well, that was wanting to employ people who weren't journalists.
Yeah, including not being journalist herself.
That's what I mean, sorry. Lebedev not wanting to employ journalists, yeah.
And, I couldn't get on with her, and she was interfering, and I just thought, okay, maybe I'll move on now. And the idea of writing just once a month appealed to me at Tatler. And it still appeals to me, rather than once a week.
And it is enjoyable at Tatler, and you have free rein there?
They're really nice to work for in that sense. They don't change anything without, discussing it. And then they don't actually ever change anything fundamentally. And I deal with lots of nice girls called Annabelle, who are polite and charming.
Yeah.
It's what you'd expect.
Yeah.
And I get on fine with Richard Denon, the editor. He's been very nice. So, yeah. I mean, the only thing I'm not keen on is they won't put it online on, I think, spurious grounds that people will buy the magazine, therefore, to read my reviews. And I don't think for a minute that obtains. But I would like it online, just that more people read the stuff.
Well, there is a thing that we do at the Oldie. I can see you don't want to kill the golden goose of the issue that's just come out, but there's no reason why after a few months...
They shouldn't do it. Yeah. Well, I'll go back to badgering them again.
And dare I say it, Faye, you've just passed a significant birthday.
80.
Yeah, it's better you say it than I do. And has your view of writing restaurant columns changed much since 1972, or do you take much the same approach 53 years on?
Well, writing once a month, I can't, and with ludicrous lead-in times. I'm just moment writing for the November issue, which is just insane in my view. So there's no...
And having to say, you don't have to say, as the autumn leaves are falling.
No. But also, a large part of the pleasure at the Standard was you could go to a restaurant on a Monday and the review would be in on Wednesday.
Yes.
Now...
And also quite a thrill writing to a tight deadline like that, isn't it?
Well, and making discoveries and then finding all the other restaurant critics following in your footsteps. That's quite nice. So that's changed completely. So I'd say the columns probably changed.
And in terms of other people's behaviour in restaurants, is it fair enough to say people have got much less drunk, but somehow have got worse manners? I haven't phrased it very well, but was there a time when people were having a much better time going out to restaurants than now?
Yes, I think so. I mean, expense tends to squash one's enjoyment, but also the way restaurants now are often designed, they're so noisy. And of course, when people start shouting to be heard, it just escalates.
You very kindly took me to one the other day where neither of us, I think, are hard of hearing, and we had to really shout. It's amazing that everyone must know hearing is one of the senses. And yet, nice people come over and say, are you enjoying your meal? They don't say, I'm sorry that you can't hear a word.
Yeah. It's weird, and so commonplace now. I mean, I went somewhere that I didn't think for a second would be one of those shout-a-thons, but it was. And it's partly, Jeremy King and Chris Corbin used to hire acoustic engineers, and that's what restaurants should do, but they're expensive and people don't bother.
To make sure it was
to
as
make
quiet
sure
as
the
possible.
Sound was muted, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, for me, the enjoyment in a restaurant is many things, but certainly conversation. So if you're having to strain, it's no fun.
And talk about Jeremy King, who's had this great comeback, reopening the Caprice, which he now has to call the Arlington.
Just Arlington.
Mm. Are you an admirer? I know you reviewed Arlington. Are you an admirer of his restaurants over the years?
Yes. I mean, Arlington became so synonymous with Jesus, maitre d', and I miss him when I go there now. I've only been once. I mean, the park is interesting. Jeremy's, a fantastic operator, but part of him has never left Joe Allen, where he started out. And so it has this sort of cod American menu, which is beginning just at the moment to come into its own because there seems to be a big American stroke New York influence at the moment on openings in London.
There's a starter. I want to take my nephew out for his 21st birthday, and we haven't yet been. But Arlington has a feel of being a kind of treat restaurant, doesn't it?
Yes.
Those places are nice.
It had a feeling of being a glamorous restaurant because it had a very glamorous clientele. I think that clientele's evaporated. And so if it doesn't have a glamorous clientele, then it's just another restaurant.
Because those glamorous people have died or they've gone elsewhere.
And Jesus is not there to cherish them as he used to.
Where is the most glamorous treat restaurant?
At the moment?
Yeah.
I think the Dover in Dover Street. That's been opened by a chap who worked at Soho House. He was the kind of head boss of restaurants, I think. Martin, somebody or other, and it is quite New York, and it's really cleverly designed. There are no windows. You can hear yourself speak. There's carpet under the tables to soak up noise. There's a brilliant cocktail bar. The food is kind of not very ambitious, but I think that's fine. And it's full of glamorous people and very nice staff. And I went there recently, and I didn't book the table. I was with a chap who booked the table. And I sat down, and the barman came over and said, a vodka martini, very dry with a twist. And I said, yeah, and that's what I'd had last time.
Oh,
and
amazing,
that's impressive.
Because you can. It's quite difficult, isn't it, being a restaurateur? What you want to have is a sense of occasion, but not the terrible hushed quietness of a country house restaurant in circa 1992.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but you want a burble, but not too loud. And at the Dover, there are no windows, so you don't know what time it is. I mean, I met this chap recently. I'm reviewing it, actually, for Tatler at the moment, at 6:15, which is not my natural eating out time, but he lives in Cambridge. And, you just didn't know what time it was, so it didn't matter. And I like that. I think it's very liberating not to know what time it is, to have no windows, not to be able to see whether it's light or dark.
And can you, after many years as a distinguished critic, you still can get excited on going to a new place?
You
must have seen every single incarnation of every single tomato, bit of lamb, bit of sea
bass.
Yes,
it's probably not so much the food that's exciting me. Although, of course, I went the other day to a restaurant just near here in Fitzrovia, which was food from Chile, which I wasn't aware of as in any particularly well-defined cuisine. And that was interesting, and it was quite good. Yeah, so there's always discoveries to be made.
And, Faye, if we can go to your personal life, you were married to Reg Gadney, who sadly died. It was your second husband, and your first husband was the publisher Tom Mashler, whose clients included John Fowles, Edna O'Brien, Bruce Chatwin, Anita Bruckner, Martin Amis, Julian Barnes, Ian McEwan. Quite a sort of dazzling set of people.
And the Americans, Joe Heller, Kurt Vonnegut, and the South Americans, he published. I remember when I was in the hospital having our first baby, and he presented me with 100 Years of Solitude to read, which when you're, you know, about to go into labour isn't ideal, but it was just such a typical tome. It's actually, in retrospect, quite a good title to be reading as I embarked on having a baby and being stuck at home.
But so you were surrounded by all these figures in the
70s and 80s. Yes, glamorous figures.
Yeah.
Mm.
And did it seem, often when you say this, people don't think it's a golden age at the time, but it, did it seem very dashing and glamorous, or sort of...
I was excited by it because it was a literary world which I was interested in. And there were some of his writers, like Philip Roth, who I grew to know and like very much. And, yeah, it was... Well, I've forgotten. Did you say, was it exciting?
Yes, did it seem... It's so often when you talk to people who've been through these dashing, glamorous worlds. They, a friend of mine, Nick Garland, the cartoonist, who worked with Barry Humphreys and Peter Cook, and had been at the Royal Court, I said, God, it was amazing. It must have been amazing to work in a golden age. And he said, in a friendly way, he said, well, we didn't know it was a golden age at the time.
Exactly, but I was aware of, obviously, some of the authors being... I mean, we had Arthur Rubinstein to dinner. We had all kinds. And
Kingsley,
thing is, I was 12 years Kingsley, and this was Jane Howard, his wife, with whom I ended up writing a cookery book. We became good friends when we both left our respective husbands. I was really lucky. I kind of wish I'd paid more attention.
Yes.
But I was about to say, I was 12 years younger than Tom, and therefore kind of in a different frame of mind in terms of what constitutes fun.
Yes, and also writers with the best will in the world, I'm not saying any of those ones in particular, but often can be absolutely brilliant on the page and not really very nice or even very interesting, and often raging egomaniacs in the flesh.
Yes, well, we used to have these dinner parties, and I remember having one dinner party with Freddie Raphael and Jonathan Miller and various others, and you'd expect it to have been a real joke fest, and of course they all just resented the others for being more successful in their view, or whatever. It was an absolute frost. And it was a lesson in that dinner parties are best with your friends.
Yes, normally two writers get together, exactly, and they talk about money and sales and how useless their publisher and editor and agent are. And restaurateurs can be slightly different by character. I think you were a friend of the great Peter Langan.
Yes.
And he, all one knows reading about him is that he was a tremendous drunk who set fire to himself. But he was a very sophisticated figure.
To him. And I don't know if you remember, but he opened Odin's and then Langan's Brasserie in Devonshire Street. And they were such lovely restaurants. He had a real talent as a restaurateur for lighting and pictures, and he and Brian Sewell went to the sales, and you know, he had very good taste. And when I met him, I was collecting recipes for something I was doing for Habitat, recipes from restaurants. It was called London à la carte. So it was the facsimile of a menu and then recipes on the back. So I went to Odin's to meet Peter, get some recipes off him. We got on well, but I had this feeling that he would get on really well with my sister, Beth. And my 30th birthday was coming up, and he said, I'll cook the meal for you at your house, which he did. It was all lobsters, I think. And he met Beth, and indeed they did hit it off, and he and Beth opened Langan's Brasserie in 1976. And he has put in writing to her that he never would have got it open but for her, largely because of the drink, but she also, you know, had steadying influence.
Because it is... as famously known, it's an incredible gamble setting up a restaurant. So you need to be... What do you think? What do you need to be? You need to be a risk taker, do you?
Yes. Bit of a visionary, bit of a gambler. I mean, what rescued Peter were two things. One thing was Richard Shepherd coming in from the capital to be the chef, because he could deal with numbers. And it's Langan's Brasserie sat 400, or did 400 probably in a day. And then he went into partnership with Michael Caine, the actor, And of course that brought in a certain clientele that established the place as the place to be.
Got a lot of coverage. I remember as a teenager reading about it, and it was always in the papers.
Yeah, always in the papers. I remember going there and shaking Jack Nicholson's hand and swearing never to wash my hands again. Cool. You know, that kind of stuff.
You've never been tempted to open a restaurant yourself?
Well, I did have a man friend. It was probably the downfall of my first marriage. And we had... Well, it was he who wanted to open a Mexican restaurant. And certainly at that time, there was nothing interesting Mexican. There weren't even tacos restaurants. And we went quite a long way to... But no, I didn't want to. I know too much of the downside and the risk and hard work and hours and,
And we'll finish on a question which will annoy you, which is, you must get asked the whole time, but what is the or one of the greatest restaurants you've been to in your 53 years of reviewing?
Well, in London, I would say the Ritz. I was there recently to celebrate my 80th birthday, and it's just faultless. And I think John Williams, the chef, is a brilliant operator, and the food's great, and... Where you'd think there would be sort of stiff, starchy staff, there are really nice, young, friendly, amusing people working
there. And not
there.
The restaurant hush of 1992.
No, not at all. And then, where else? Well, when I'm asked, what's your favourite restaurant? It's a place called Riva in Barnes, where I've spent many happy celebrations of birthdays and things, or just evenings or lunches. And Andrea Riva is the owner, and he's there every day, and if he's not there, he closes the restaurant. And when I go, and when his regulars go, and many regulars make up the clientele, he just sends out food, which, I mean, this sounds kind of stupid, but it's the ultimate luxury not to have to choose.
Well, I think that's a very good place to stop, and thank you so much to Faye Mashler for appearing on Radio Aldi.
Thank you, Harry.
You have been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.thealdi.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.